From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studios. Coming up on today's show, we'll talk about the destructive side of water, flooding, with snow and ice melting all around us. We'll find out what preparations are in place against potential floods in some of our listening area. But first, it's drinking water. We'll get updates on pollution issues threatening the drinking water of multiple communities in our listening area. Hear about a ballot initiative that puts water quality front and center, and get the details of an upcoming symposium looking at what's in our drinking water. Joining us are three guests today, and I'm glad to have each of them. Lee Donahue, first of all, is the with the Town of Campbell Board. She's the Health, Education, and Welfare Supervisor there. Lee, thank you much for being on Newsmakers again.
Thank you for the invitation. I appreciate the opportunity.
Pat Wilson is with the Cooley Region Sierra Club. He's a board member there, and he's also active with the Wisconsin Sierra Club. Pat, thanks for joining us on Newsmakers.
Thank you, Ezra. Good to be here.
And Jamie O'Neill is with Viterbo University, and she's coordinator of an interesting symposium that we'll talk about later called What's in Our Drinking Water. And she's also a member of the La Crosse County Board and played a part in making sure that a referendum that we're going to be talking about is, in fact, on the ballot. Jamie, thank you very much for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
A couple of the issues related to drinking water are more general, and we'll talk about those. But in the news for the last little while, at least in the couple of years since I've moved back to town, is this issue in the town of Campbell, this PFAS issue. That Lee, you've been just neck deep dealing with this. And the last time we talked, in fact, it was all about this. Why don't you start by giving people a bit of an overview of what PFAS chemicals are and how you became aware of that issue as a problem in the town of Campbell on French Island?
So PFAS are a man-made compound. It's not something that you find in nature. And because of that, it is a very difficult compound to break down. It doesn't degrade. It doesn't degrade in soil. It doesn't degrade in water. And as a matter of fact, it's incredibly difficult to break the bond in PFAS, which is part of the problem. You can't get rid of it. It doesn't break down. Folks in the town of Campbell first found out about PFAS in our water in October of 2020. And since then, we have been actively working for both short, intermediate, and long-term safe water solutions to figure out what we're going to do so that every resident can have a safe source of water. We're currently on temporary bottled water. Not like individual bottles, but big 5-gallon jugs that you have at your home. And that is obviously a short-term solution, and we're working toward long-term solutions. There's a lot of technology that is being developed, and our goal is to find out if some of that technology could perhaps assist us so that potentially we could even turn our private wells back on again.
The bottled water situation, which you've called temporary, has been in place for well over a year in your area. What kinds of solutions do you see? I mean, is everybody in the town of Campbell going to have to retrofit their house or business with some kind of filter, or are there other solutions that could be part of the equation?
Well, there are a lot of different considerations. The one big consideration for us right now is that La Crosse County and actually the state of Wisconsin do not have any safe processes for dealing with a highly concentrated contaminated filter. So if you had a filter at your sink or in your basement that could potentially filter the water that is coming into your home and that you were drinking, that highly concentrated contaminated filter now becomes hazardous waste. And there is not currently a mechanism to deal with that hazardous waste. So we don't want to be rearranging PFAS from my home to your home to the landfill to some other location where PFAS could potentially be stored or destroyed, which again, destruction is very, very difficult. So we want to look at solutions that are going to address it in such a way that our problem doesn't become somebody else's problem.
When we spoke last time, it's been over a year now, but when we spoke, there was a lot that was unknown and that people were still learning about. I'm curious to know, as you've kind of been living this for a year and a half or so now, what adjustments you've had to make. I mean, is this water that you've got to drink with the safe bottled water? Of course, I would imagine you're cooking with it. What about things like watering the lawn, gardening, those? I mean, can you grow tomatoes in your yard and then eat them using well water, or do you have to put bottled water on that too?
Well, it's a really good question. When the Department of Health issued the health advisory last year for the entire island, that meant that everyone was advised to use bottled water for all sources of ingestion. So I honestly have a giant raspberry, I'll call it a patch, but it really extends the entire width of my backyard. It's about 15 feet wide and maybe 100 feet long. And I don't feel confident eating those because we've been told by the DHS that vegetables do uptake the water from the ground. And so if the ground is contaminated with PFAS, I don't know that tomatoes, raspberries, corn, or anything else that I would grow in my backyard would be safe to eat.
I'm sorry, I'm literally just thinking about this right now. It never occurred to me until you mentioned it. It's not even a matter of what kind of water you're using. It's a matter of you'd have to replace the entire ground to be able to grow things safely.
And we know that PFAS is so highly mobile. It moves through the ground and the groundwater very easily. And when you're an island hugged by two rivers on either side, you know, those river waters go up and they go down, and that all affects the groundwater flow. So the reason that the DNR and the DHS issued this health advisory is because you may have tested your well one day, and yet as that groundwater shifts slightly with the rivers going up and down, with rain, with snow melt, the water paths may change slightly. So one day your PFAS number may be different than the next day or the next week or the next month. And you really just can't predict where it's going to go next. And in the meanwhile, the plumes of contamination are growing throughout the island. We have found that through the testing of our three public buildings, which were tested originally in fall of 2020, and then tested again in spring of 2021. And each one of those had a higher level of contamination than the testing that was done 6 months before.
One more question before we set this issue aside for the moment. What are the next steps in this process that people should be looking forward to?
Well, one of the next steps that we have, I've been doing some research on some technologies that could perhaps help us develop a way to encapsulate the contamination actually in the ground. We're also looking into new groundwater studies. The last groundwater studies that were conducted by USGS were done roughly 20 years ago. And we know that the structure underneath the ground, the geological structure, it changes over time. And the bedrock changes, some of the other rock formations change. And we want to make certain that we're looking at that so that whatever our long-term solution is going to be, it's not going to be impacted by ways that the water flow may change or how the geology under the island may change as well.
I thought of one additional question that I just can't leave this issue without asking. It's supposed, at least it was in my last conversations about this, that this contamination is the result of the chemicals used at the La Crosse airport. And I'm wondering, has their use of those chemicals, I know the FAA has to be involved in all that, has their use of those chemicals stopped? Are they in a position where they have gotten the permission that they need to use alternatives?
The FAA has not granted a single request to use an alternate non-fluorinated foam. And that affects not only our community, but every airport community in the nation. I will say, however, that in areas like Australia, the UK, Germany, Denmark, they have been using non-fluorinated foams for more than a decade at some of the largest airports, including Heathrow. And they have used those effectively. So there are foams out there that are not toxic to the environment, like the ones that are currently being mandated by the FAA to be used at airports.
That's very interesting. Lee Donahue is a board member in the town of Campbell. Joining us also today, Patrick Wilson from the Cooley Region Sierra Club. Pat, you were telling me in some of our email exchange about another water quality issue in our area that was in the news a few years back on Bryce Prairie. Tell me about that, some groundwater contamination that was going on there. And to your knowledge, has that been resolved?
The problem on Bryce Prairie was nitrates in the water and in some cases bacterial contamination. There are some things that have been done, but essentially the problem is still there. And some people are using bottled water or other means of getting their water. And the problem on Bryce Prairie is that it's on a sandy bench along the Mississippi River. So the soil is very sandy. The groundwater is 20 to 30 feet below the surface. And so there's not a lot of filtering of material that gets on the surface of the land before it gets to the groundwater. And so the houses that have been built out on Bryce Prairie were told by the county that they should be tested 2-3 years ago, and 30% of the houses tested above the state recommended level of 10 milligrams per liter. And so they investigated what the source of the nitrates is, and one of the things is that there is a CAPO confined animal feeding operation out on Bryce Prairie, and it had test wells around their waste management system, and the test wells indicated high levels of nitrates on 60, 70, 80% of the tests that were done starting in, I think it was 2010. So that's one source, the CAFO, and there are other sources besides that, and it can't. I doubt that it's all the source of all the problem. But there's also individual septic systems at the houses. They're a source of nitrates in water. Excessive fertilizer spread on a field could be a source of nitrate. And so, it is a hard thing to address. And I said 30% of the wells tested high in nitrates on Bryce Prairie. Statewide, they say 8% of private wells test high for nitrates. So it's to some extent a problem all over the state. The DNR did start a process of redefining how agriculture should spread animal waste. And that NR 151 revision was going on, but it was stopped about 6 months ago, I'd say, because the state legislature indicated that they weren't going to pass these new rules anyway. So DNR said, why work on them? The other thing was, well, there are some recommendations out of the county health department that would be useful. And one is that any new subdivisions, any new housing developments on Bryce Prairie shouldn't be built unless they have municipal water and municipal sewer. And another thing was to extend municipal water to the houses that exist on Bryce Prairie. A third thing they recommended was having green spaces around the housing developments where no fertilizer would be spread, or no pesticides or no chemicals spread. One of the problems with that is that they say the groundwater moves 3 feet per day towards the river on Bryce Prairie. So whatever is in the water does eventually spread.
Interesting. That's Pat Wilson of the Coulee Region Sierra Club. Joining us today as well is Jamie O'Neill, and Jamie is a La Crosse County Board member, and she's with Viterbo University organizing an event that we'll talk about later. But Jamie, in your capacity on the La Crosse County Board, you along with Pat have been instrumental in introducing a clean water referendum that's making its way in different forms throughout the state. And it's on the ballot in an election that is coming up on April 4th, in addition to some school. It's not a huge election, so people may be less aware of it. So a bunch of areas have school board candidates who are being voted for. A couple of areas I've seen there are mayoral elections, another major issue in La Crosse County is this clean water referendum. Tell me about that referendum and why you think it is important.
Well, it's really important for the issues that we've already been talking about, but then maybe also some unforeseen water issues at this point. Having our county vote on this and showing that it is a priority, I believe, will bring more attention and also potentially more funding to this area to help mitigate and work on, again, either future problems or problems that we're having now. Hopefully, right, people have everyone's health and wellness in their best mind or in their best practices and will be voting yes. That date is Tuesday, April 5th. And like you said, there will be school board on there as well. There will also be county board elections at that time. So I do hope people get out and vote on Tuesday, April 5th.
I think I said the 4th, and that's certainly my mistake. Sorry about that. The referendum is pretty short as ballot initiatives go. The text of it is, should the state of Wisconsin establish a right to clean water to protect human health, the environment, and the diverse culture and natural heritage of Wisconsin? And you can either vote yes or no. But the referendum is non-binding. What does that mean? And why is it non-binding?
Sure. I believe that just means that there is nothing attached to it in terms of things that will specifically happen because of this. And there is no, other than a little bit of money that went towards getting it on the ballot, there is no money that is attached to this. So voting yes does not mean a certain, you know, amount of county funding will be allocated towards clean water.
Pat, in terms of advocacy for something like this, it seems like, I mean, everybody wants clean drinking water, and it seems just sort of self-evident that people would support clean water. However, some people might say a non-binding referendum on the ballot and the expense that it goes through to put it there, and there's no real teeth to it once it's done. What's the point to it?
As for the cost, we were told by the three counties that already had this referendum that it was about $250 to put it on an existing ballot. We're not having a special election. It is part of the normal election. The point, let me go back and say the River Alliance of Wisconsin is the organization that has started this drive, and we'd like to get this passed in every county in Wisconsin. And the purpose is to show our state legislature that people in Wisconsin really want clean water. They're committed to clean water, and that we want some action from state government. And, you know, some of the things lately are cause for concern, like stopping work on NR 151 to eliminate nitrate, or not eliminate, but reduce nitrate pollution in the groundwater. And recently, the DNR came forward with their recommendations for what to do with PFAS, and that was gutted by the Natural Resources Board. They turned down the guidelines on groundwater, PFAS and groundwater. They increased the levels of PFAS allowed in drinking water, and that doesn't help us here.
We're talking with Pat Wilson, who's with the Coulee Region Sierra Club. He's also on the water team with the Wisconsin Sierra Club. Jamie O'Neill is with Viterbo University and is also a member of the La Crosse County Board. And Lee Donahue is a member of the board for the town of Campbell. I'm appreciative of their time today, and we're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. We'll find out about an upcoming symposium called What's in Our Drinking Water? A very interesting question indeed, and that is the subject of conversation next. If you would like to get in touch with the program, you can reach out to us. We'd always love to hear from you at newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall from our studios on the campus of UW-La Crosse. We're talking today with Lee Donahue, Pat Wilson, and Jamie O'Neill about the quality of our drinking water. And in light of that conversation, Jamie, you are helping to organize a very interesting symposium that's upcoming at Viterbo University here in La Crosse. And it's called What's in Our Drinking Water? So let me ask you, how did this question come about?
Yeah. So we are super lucky. We got a donation from an alumni at Viterbo to put on an annual symposium. This is our first one, and the committee chose drinking water because we felt it is something that is very important to both our community and to our students at Viterbo.
And tell me about the who, what, when, where, et cetera, about the What Is Our Drinking Water event.
Great. So it is coming up next Friday, March 25th, and it will be both in person at Viterbo University, and people can also stream or Zoom in to do it right from the comfort of their own home. It's free, but people do have to register in order to get the links and the directions for the symposium. We have a lot of great speakers coming in from around the nation. On Thursday night, the night before, Aaron Brockovich will be kicking off. That is a free event. That one actually you do not have to register for. We have 1,200 seats in our auditorium. And as soon as those are filled, then I guess I should say seating is limited. So if people really want to go, they should try to get there maybe a little early. But again, for Friday, you can register. And we have a keynote. Her name is Jeannie Purchase. She'll be coming from Washington, D.C. to talk about the great work that she's done in New Jersey, in Washington, D.C., getting lead out of pipes. And then we'll have experts from Wisconsin and the nation breaking down different contamination problems that we're seeing.
That's interesting. Of course, people are going to be very familiar with the name Aaron Brockovich because of the Julia Roberts movie from some years ago. But really, she's been an enormously influential figure in taking to task people who have caused such horrible pollution issues all over the country. The speakers, are they all going to be here in person, or are they going to be streamed in virtually? I know we've all gotten used to seeing video screens of people in the last couple of years, but this is all happening like live and in person, right?
This is all live and in person. All of the speakers, including Aaron Brockovich, will be here in La Crosse and on the Viterbo campus for the symposium. We really do encourage, if people are feeling safe, to come on and enjoy it in person. There will be opportunities to ask questions to the speakers. So we do think that'll be important. We also have 10 different organizations joining us at booths throughout the day that people can ask questions to and get water information from. And we have a networking area and a photo booth. So we do think that in-person experience will trump everything else, but you can also experience it virtually if you would like to stay home or if you are watching from a distance. We just are dropping the mask mandate this week. So next week, it will not be a mandate at the campus to have a mask. However, we recommend them if people would like.
And where can people find more information if they'd like to register or get links to participate online or whatever?
All of that information is on the Viterbo website, so viterbo.edu. And if you type in science symposium or what's in our water, the website will come up, which has the registration and links for the day.
And you said that this is intended to become an annual event, which is interesting. What kinds of things are you hoping to deal with in the future?
I would like to do water every year, although unfortunately it will switch topics. Our next symposium will be September 2022, so in just a few short months, and the topic will be medicine and ethics.
Interesting. Jamie O'Neill, in addition to her position on the county board in La Crosse, is with Viterbo University and has been talking to us about what's in our drinking water. Thanks a lot, Jamie.
Thank you.
Pat Wilson, before we go, I want to give you an opportunity to let people know about the Sierra Club and what you guys are involved in and how people might find information about that.
The local Sierra Club group has been active here since 1967, I think, and address a lot of environmental issues. We're part of the state and national Sierra Club. And if you go to the Sierra Club website, sierraclub.org, you can find the Wisconsin chapter and the Cooley region group you can get to through the Wisconsin chapter. And if you join, you join them all.
All right. Pat Wilson with the Sierra Club. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Lee Donahue is on the board of the town of Campbell. And Lee, I know we've talked about so much that impacts your area. In terms of what the public needs to know, what action do you need people to take on your behalf in order to get ahead of some of these issues?
Well, one of the great things that I've had the opportunity to do is to collaborate with a lot of scientific organizations and a lot of environmental groups, as well as state and federal legislators. And we are having a listening session next Wednesday, so a week from today at 1:30 in the afternoon at Olivet Lutheran Church, just across from our town hall. And it's an opportunity for folks to speak with Representative Ron Kind and Senator Brad Paff, and to talk about their concerns in regard to PFAS and safe drinking water. So I'm very grateful to have a lot of collaborations with the not only our elected officials, but also USGS, which is here on the island as well. And one of the presenters at Viterbo, Dr. Paul Bradley, is actually one of the USGS presenters and part of his national tap water study, which the town of Campbell is a part of. So it's a good feeling to know that, unfortunately, our contaminated water can be part of a research project that can help not only us, but potentially many others across the United States.
And that's on Wednesday the 23rd at Olivet, right?
Correct, at 1:30 in the afternoon.
That sounds good. Lee, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We have been talking to Lee Donahue, Pat Wilson, and Jamie O'Neill. Coming up next, the destructive side of water, flooding, with snow and ice melting all around us. Find out what preparations are in place against potential floods. We'll hear from Monroe County Land Conservation Department Director Bob McKeel. Remember, you can hear this conversation again or stream any of our previous episodes on demand. Just go to WPR.org/newsmakers. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest studios. We have all seen the extensive damage that can be caused by flooding. The economic costs are absolutely staggering, but so is the threat to life. The National Weather Service says nearly 150 people died in U.S. floods in 2021. Joining us to talk about the impact of flooding and what's being done in part of our listening area is Bob McKeel. He's the director of the Monroe County Land Conservation Department and president of the Wisconsin Land and Water Association. Bob, welcome back to Newsmakers.
Thank you, and great to be back.
So we're talking about flooding. It seems like such a huge issue, and what in the world can you say about it in just 20 minutes? But I've seen reports. I didn't live in the area in the time, but I've read a lot about the flooding that happened some years ago throughout the area. The stories that get told and retold a lot happened around Coon Valley, where it was particularly manifested. Now, compared to then, compared to 20, 30 years ago, are we at a greater risk of flooding now than previously?
I always go back to 2007. That's, for me, is kind of when I noticed things started changing. And I've been doing conservation work for over 30 years here. So I look at 2007 was the start of these big events tracking across through the Driftless area. It seems like Southern Monroe County and Northern Vernon County is kind of the crux or the new equator. It just seems like all these events, if we have them, that's where they're going to track through. So we look at 2007 and then we come forward. We've tracked through the Driftless area and the National Weather Service over 20 major events affecting this area. When I say major, I'm talking millions of dollars in damage. Mm. The big difference is not necessarily the volume, but the rainfall intensity. What we used to, you know, talk about getting 2-3 inches over a night, which is a nice rain. Now we get 2-3 inches in 20 minutes. That's the game changer, that intensity. And then you marry that with what's going on in the landscape. Our landscape is changing. We have more development in the rural landscape. Farming community has changed. The dairy has been removed and there's more cash grain in the Driftless area. So you have that monoculture married with that intense rain event creates some huge issues when it comes to flooding and these runoff events.
In terms of the changing of the way, literally changing the way rain falls in the area, do you know what that's attributable to?
It's that temperature, the Wisconsin, they call it WICI, which basically stands for the Wisconsin Institute of Climate Change Impacts, just recently came out with their 2021 assessment. And from that, the temperature is spiking up. And what we're seeing is it's happening more in the evenings and over the winter time periods, that temperature change. And so when you have that temperature change, evaporation increases, that heating element carrying more precipitation. And when it does come down and it's isolated, you could have one watershed that has a half inch of rain and go over the hill and add 4 inches of rain. So that intensity with that heat is what's creating the issue. We've had varying intense rainfall events that have gone all the way up to 6 to 8 inches in an hour and a half. There's nothing we can do to plan or design for that. We can't design our way out of that, but we have to adapt and mitigate that issue.
That's an astounding amount of water in a short amount of time. And you know, one of my questions is what can you do to anticipate that? So like, I know you mentioned you can't do anything about that specific thing. I mean, in preparation for that, there's just no way to accommodate that. But what do you have to do to, as you said, mitigate that or prepare yourself for what could come of that?
So in 2019, Monroe County moved forward with the development of the Monroe County Climate Change Task Force. And it really gets at what was going on in our county. The intensity of these rain events, the amount, it's not a 100-year event every 10 years or 100 years. No, it's every year. And so we were getting beat up pretty good. And financially, you look at it, in the decade of the 90s, our property and infrastructure damage was about 33,000. The last 10 years, it's 33 million. We cannot continue to go down the same track. So that was one of the reasons for developing a climate change task force and look at what can we do? Well, first and foremost, we can keep people and structures out of the floodway. That's the least we could do. And how do we do that? Well, we need more information to do a better job of predicting. And the National Weather Service is obviously our professional service that does that. And we have lack of information in these watersheds, specifically in Monroe County. So we put an effort together to actually get purchase weather monitoring stations. We had a village president living in this area, like the Kickapoo watershed, that went out and knocked on doors for donations, raised $20,000. We were successful in some grants. So we started deploying these weather monitoring stations in the Kickapoo and La Crosse watershed. And what they do is they obviously collect precipitation. We can measure intensity, but also we're also measuring that base flow or that flood flow when it comes up. So all that information goes to a cloud that the National Weather Service has access and monitors. And so they interpret the information. So the more information we can provide from Monroe County residents, they can evaluate that information and then kick out the warnings either direct to the public or they can get it to dispatch and our emergency management government. And if you're signed up for NICSL, you're going to get a warning right to the palm of your hand concerning flooding. So that's one of the objectives we've taken on.
You talked about watersheds a couple of times and some of the different ones that are in your area. Everybody knows, what a river is, a lake, a creek. Specifically, what constitutes a watershed? Is that just where the water drains following a rain?
So the landscape, you can basically, in the driftless area, roads, if you go across a ridgetop, are typically right on the crest of the watershed breaks. Just because that's kind of a level spot where the water, if it's raining, which direction does it flow? Which stream does it flow towards? That's your watershed boundary. So if you look at the Kickapoo watershed, it's hundreds of square miles that feed into the Kickapoo River, covering multiple counties. The interesting thing about Monroe County is we have five river systems, stream systems that actually originate in Monroe County and flow outward to our neighboring counties. So what happens here definitely has an impact on our neighbors. Classic example is the Kickapoo River, Vernon County, the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. You have a lot of recreation down there. We might have Vernon County might have a half inch in that area, and we have 4 inches up in the upper end of the Kickapoo River. Next thing you know, their campers are running for cover and they got canoers stranded on the river system, and there's no way to convey that information. So you can see the watershed dynamics are complicated, yet I think there's opportunity for doing a better job of alerting people. And that's one of the things we're trying to accomplish with these weather monitoring stations.
You talked about one of those goals of the Monroe County Climate Change Task Force. There are 10 of them all together. What are a couple of the other ones?
One of the other ones is evaluating the floodplain as far as removing structures out of the floodway. And because of the 2018 flood event, Monroe County was declared federally for federal funding through the FEMA. And so we had numerous structures that were consistently getting damaged during these big events, and they're in the floodway. And so we were fortunate enough to secure enough money that we actually purchased 8 of the homes, basically appraised their values prior to all these flood events. So they got a fair price. And they could go find a place outside of the floodway on drier property and live. And we purchased the homes, and basically it took about 2 years of paper shuffling to get all the funds lined up, appraisals, et cetera. And then all those structures were removed and will stay in perpetuity in green space. So that's open space that covers about 18 acres on the La Crosse and La Crosse rivers. So that's one thing. We're mm-hmm. also doing crossings. We're doing assessments across Monroe County. Monroe County has 1,700 crossings. And when I say crossings, I mean bridges and culverts. So last year we started by hiring a couple interns to basically evaluate these crossings for conditions. What is their integrity? Are they barriers to the fishery? And how do they stack up when it comes to climate resiliency? So that's all queued into a software package that ranks all the structures. So these towns would have a fair assessment when it's time to upgrade, that they can target their resources and we can help find them funds to get these culverts replaced and be more flood resilient. That's another thing we've been working on. The other thing is we're wrapping up the Monroe County Climate Change Assessment. And that is something we've been taking on with the Wisconsin Green Fire and taking a look at Monroe County as far as vulnerable to these intense weather extremes or weather events. And so we've kind of broken that up into four sub-teams looking at agriculture, forestry, infrastructure, and then the climate hydrology piece. So the outcome of that, and that's going to be unveiled next week in the final report, is we got basically 18 strategies looking at climate change and the impacts to Monroe County, along with economic opportunity, with 80 recommendations. So our climate change task force has a lot to weed through and opportunity to look at, getting some more progress in this county done.
Let me ask you about, you talked about after the 2018 event, some federal funding became available. A lot of these mitigation strategies, it sounds expensive to me. What role does state and federal funding play in this? And have you experienced any barriers in terms of getting to that available funding?
The declaration was the key that opens the door for federal funding through FEMA. And that was a portion of the funds. I think it was around 70 or 75% of the funds that would be available to complete the buyout program. So where are we getting the remaining portion? So we had Cooley Cap was a partner. We had the DNR Municipal Grant, Dam Grant Program. And so I'm fortunate enough that we have a land use planner, a grant writer that can chase funds down. We have our zoning administrator that was very active in this project. So we had two people that focused almost 2 years of chasing funds and putting all the paperwork together, working with landowners to make this happen. And when I say make this happen, once that paperwork was complete and bidding it out to private contractors to complete the decommissioning, it took about 1 day to erase everything that was there. The other thing is people, when we talk about removing a structure, we don't talk about the human element. And I can tell you that everybody that we've ever talked to about the opportunity to buy them out and get them out of a situation that is flooding and the thought of night rolls around and lightning storm creeps up, is the water gonna come up against their house? And what does that mean for them? So that emotional detachment from that house is overwhelming, and that burden removed. There's a lot of people pretty happy that this opportunity came along.
They've got to be happy about providing better safety. And I'm wondering, I don't know if this is the case specifically in these areas, but a lot of the people that have experienced flooding are talking about property that perhaps been in their family for generations even. And so there's an emotional attachment there, even if there is a recognition that for safety reasons, we have to think about getting out of here. I mean, this has been maybe the family farm for, 100 years.
And that's the thing, is that attachment to the property. I mean, their dreams of owning a house or this was the family farm, that's a very strong attachment. And for most cases, it took repeated events. When I say repeated, 4 or 5 times of their home basically being destroyed and rebuilding it. Before they were to the point where, yes, we need to get out of here for our own safety and sake, this isn't working out. And quite honestly, we can't predict the future, but our models and what the professionals are saying scientific-wise, that this is only going to increase. So it's only in their best nature, but still, it's a very emotional. Money is part of it, but that emotional attachment is a huge component of getting people out of harm's way.
You talked about both climate change and the changing use of the land, development of it, plant crops versus, in the old days, maybe dairy or, monoculture versus in the old days, more of a mixture of what's going on the land contributing to all of this. But this idea of a 100-year event happening year after year after year. How long can that go on before we have to stop calling these things 100-year events?
That's a very good question. So a lot of our design work is based on historic rain events or precipitation models. And we use the Atlas 14, they call it. And so that is based on all the historic rain events up to about 2012. And so we design in our conservation world our practices based on that. So if you take a 10-year storm event, that's a 4.2-inch rain in Monroe County. If we were to now march that forward to 2021, would it be 4.2? Probably not. It's going to be a little more precipitation. But on that note, we had the University of Wisconsin take a look at the precipitation levels that we've been experiencing. And so for those designed storm events in the last 30 years would increase between 0.5 inch and 1 inch. That's significant in our world of designing, whether it's culverts, bridges, dams, et cetera. Now, along with that is that land use change. We also had another study in Rulins Coulee, which is the upper reaches of the Coon Creek watershed. From 2004 to 2018, somewhere in there. In that short time period, the conservation practices that were pretty common in the Driftless area, the contour strips, and contour strips where it means you have a hay strip, you have a corn strip, you have a hay strip, you have a corn strip. So it alternates as you go up the slope. 28% we've lost in an upper portion of Coon Creek watershed. Those are conservation practices that hold water on the landscape. Now what you find is the whole farm is in one crop. So what's going on is the equipment is bigger, the dairies are gone, and they're rotating the farm instead of the contour strip. So the whole farm is in corn or beans. So that water retention factor is really dwindled considerably when you take the strips out.
Hmm. That's interesting. I learned two things just now. I learned the impact of the decision to do it that way, and I also learned what those strips are. I've for my entire life wondered why, when you drive through farm country, you see alternating strips of one crop and another crop.
And that's been the signature of the Driftless area for a long time, and basically it goes back to the first federal watershed in the United States was in Coon Valley, and a lot of our conservation work practices that we use today were born there, and the contour strips were one of them. And they work. And our studies and continued efforts looking at modeling, looking at land use combined with the precipitation goes back to our conservation practices. We need to maintain those things and try and get them back on the landscape if we're going to be successful, not only economically viable for agriculture, but also our water bodies that are receiving them on a sediment and nutrients.
I want to know what isn't getting enough attention, and not necessarily thinking of in terms of just public awareness of it, but in terms of people who can be decision makers in this process, people who have a role to play in mitigating the effects of this flooding that we've been seeing in more recent years. What isn't getting enough attention?
Well, I think that the important part is having that conversation. That was the one thing leading up to 2019, the creation of the Climate Change Task Force. It just didn't happen overnight. There was many conversations with my Natural Resource and Extension Committee about what's going on in the landscape with this amount of flooding. Things are changing. The rainfall intensity is increasing. Just having a conversation. It doesn't have to be in Monroe County. It could be anywhere in our area. Having this discussion. And the simple things that people can do to make a difference. And you will look at research and anything and everything. The simple fact of planting a tree in your yard, whether you own 10,000 square feet or 10,000 acres, planting a tree does wonders. And what does it do? Well, it provides shade. It mitigates that heat in the winter and the cold. And then the other thing it sequesters carbon. I mean, that's a big sink when it can take that carbon CO2 out of the atmosphere and park it in the soil. So that's the one simple thing everybody can do. There's a lot of unknowns when it comes to a carbon sequestration. With the Climate Change Task Force, we're always looking for expertise to bring in and have these conversations. The potential for future carbon credits through agriculture or forestry are opportunities. Making that happen will be key. Will be our businesses, our big companies investing in this opportunity, and we just got to make sure we're set up to take advantage of that. And that's really the crux of working with Greenfire on this Monroe County Economic Opportunity and Climate Resilience Project.
Bob McKeel is the director of the Monroe County Land Conservation Department and president of the Wisconsin Land and Water Association. We've been talking about flooding. We've really just been scratching the surface on flooding. But Bob, I certainly appreciate your expertise today.
Well, thank you. It's such a beautiful day to ruin it with the discussion of flooding. But thank you for the opportunity.
Always glad to ruin your day, Bob. Thanks a lot. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's how you can listen to our program every week. We're on Friday morning at 10 on the Ideas Network 90.3 and Friday night at 7 on NPR News and Music 88.9. And of course, we're always online at WPR.org/newsmakers. For producer Dawn Jewell, I'm Ezra Wall. Join us again next time for another Newsmakers right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.